1 week after Orlando's deadly mass shooting, bipartisan measures on gun control go down to defeat in the U.S. Senate. Good morning and live from Studio 5. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. Thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross. We're always live at 9. Make sure to subscribe to the daily podcast on iTunes and Stitcher and watch the show video on demand at the website tvjax.com. Just ahead, we want your calls on last night's failed vote in the Senate on gun control. Get on the line now. Let us know where you stand and what you think about that at 549-2937. Then later, a preview of the PBS film The Committee. Plus, find out about the city's new Formosan Termite Task Force. All of that and more coming up this morning. But first this hour, senators could not pull together enough bipartisan support last night to pass a series of gun control measures, the latest in a long string of failed attempts at enacting tighter restrictions on firearms in the United States. They were spurred by the worst mass shooting in U.S. history, the deadly massacre at the Pulse nightclub in Orlando. Senators from each party both introduced measures they said would strengthen background checks and prevent suspected terrorists from obtaining weapons. But our current poisonous election year politics and disputes over the effectiveness of each party's ideas proved too much to break the long-standing partisan gridlock in the Capitol that has surrounded gun issues for decades now. Josh Gellers is an assistant professor of political science at UNF, and he's actually in Washington, D.C. this morning. He's on the line with more about last night's vote. Josh, thanks for being with us.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
And we're already getting your calls. We want your calls and feedback about last night's votes in the Senate on gun control that did not pass. Give us a call. Let us know what you think. 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Or go online to wjctnews.org/firstcoastconnect. Email, tweet the show, weigh in on our Facebook page. Josh, the result, the votes not passing, that was not unexpected.
Correct. So there were these four amendments to a larger spending bill for the Commerce and Justice Department. These were amendments that dealt with the gun control issue, and they fell largely along partisan lines, not unlike what happened in December in the wake of the San Bernardino shootings, when the same result kind of happened. And so most people and onlookers and observers felt that this was exactly what they would anticipate happening.
And these votes came about after an extraordinary 15-hour filibuster that was kicked off by Senator Chris Murphy, a Democrat from Connecticut, who's been vocal about this issue since the mass shooting at the elementary school in Newtown, Connecticut. The gridlock on this issue is so entrenched, though, that it seemed as though hope of any kind of passage, even in the wake of the Newtown shootings, was faint at best.
Yeah, so as people suspected, the votes came down largely along party lines. There were only a couple of defectors. The largest number of votes that any one of the amendments earned was 53, but it needed 60. So there were definitely several votes shy of being able to attain that important number. But there's a little bit of a glimmer of hope today in that Senator Susan Collins, who's a Republican from Maine, has decided that she is going to unveil a bipartisan compromise today that she feels will address some of the lingering issues on both sides of the aisle. And that's supposed to happen later today.
And what are the specifics of that legislation?
So in particular, it looks like what she's intending to do is prevent people who are on two of the FBI's terror watch lists, and it's not exactly sure how many different watch lists there are, but the two in particular that she's interested in addressing are the no-fly list and the selectee list, which is what Omar Mateen had been on back in 2014 before he was taken off. And so under her proposal, if you are on either of these lists and you are denied your right to buy a gun, you can challenge it in court, and if you win, the government has to pay your legal costs. So it's kind of an after-the-fact way of having individuals who feel that their rights have been infringed upon receive some kind of compensation for what they feel is like an unjust move to restrict their rights.
We'll go to your calls on this in just a moment. The number to join the show, 549-2937. Let's talk about the election year politics of this. Republicans are arguing that this is not so much a matter of gun control as America's failed attempts to confront Islamic radicalism. On the other side of the debate, Democrats are saying that they're going to politicize this and try to paint the Republicans as being on the side of terrorists. For example, a liberal Senator Elizabeth Warren tweeted last night that the Senate GOP has decided to sell weapons to ISIS. How do you see the politics of this playing out over the next 5-6 months leading up to the election, the presidential election?
Well, so what's really interesting about this is that you have on the Democratic side two candidates who, both of whom have been, at least as of late, very clear about what they intend to do if they are elected to the office of president. And so Hillary Clinton has been very clear about this in saying that no one should be able to purchase a firearm if they have any suspected terrorist links. She's endorsed closing the gun show loophole, prohibiting anyone on the no-fly list from being able to buy guns. Senator Bernie Sanders has he voted with the Democrats on all four of the amendments, right along party lines. He has been criticized in the past for taking a softer stance on gun control because of the state that he represents, Vermont, where there's a lot of hunting, and he's made his position clear on that. But as of late, he has been a little bit more strict. So in 2015, in the wake of the San Bernardino shootings, he said that we need to significantly expand and improve background checks. We need to renew the assault weapons ban and the sale of high-capacity magazines, make gun trafficking a federal crime, close the gun show loophole. And then, of course, we have Donald Trump, who has, in the past week, had basically conflicting statements about his perspective on gun control. He came out in the wake of the Orlando shooting saying that this was via Twitter, had people in the nightclub been armed, and this wouldn't have happened. Then he walked it back when he was criticized by the NRA because the head of the NRA, Rain LaPierre, said that it would be a mistake to have people who are armed in a place where lots of people are drinking, because that can lead to all kinds of issues, as you might imagine. And then he, on the issue of the terrorist watch list, he modified his position once he decided to address what the NRA had been promoting and said that, you know, the concern is that people might be added to the terrorist watch list who shouldn't be, and then that might be a restriction of their rights. And Senator Ted Kennedy famously was briefly for a time on a watch list. And so that kind of highlights the point that there's a need to balance security with freedom. And I think that so the two Democratic candidates have been pretty clear in the past several weeks or even year or two. And Donald Trump is kind of finding his footing as he reaches out to the Democratic or the Republican base and the NRA.
And as we speak with UNF's Josh Gellers about last night's votes in the Senate on gun control, we want your calls right now at 549-2937. Chuck at the beaches. Chuck, good morning.
Good morning, guys. I wanted to just touch base on a couple of things real quick. Our forefathers were very past tense, present tense, and future tense oriented. And if you look at our history, we've always had, and I'm going to just use the term assault weapons or any kind of weapon, everywhere, all over the United States. And I'll just bring up one thing that you probably all are familiar with. You remember the rifleman, Lucas McCain? That rifle he had fired 13 rounds in 3 seconds. Now, here's why you would need that rifle. If you lived in Mississippi in 1930 and you lived out in the country with your wife and your two elderly sons and you were black, you would have to defend yourself, perhaps, in the middle of the night from 20 KKK members. So our forefathers were smart enough to know to let that family have five of those rifles, like Lucas McCain had on the rifleman, which at that time was the most advanced technologically assault weapon, so that they could defend themselves. And then if you think about today, just on the street, a woman, if she wants to defend herself against a man in a sexual assault, the only way she would be able to do that would be with a handgun. And our forefathers were smart enough to know that in 2060 or 2170, there might be another group like the KKK or people who wanted to put you on a train to Auschwitz. So they were smart enough to let us know that we needed the most an assault weapon like Lucas McCain had on the rifleman to defend himself. And then the other thing, too, if you look at Australia, our President Obama mentions Australia. They don't allow you to have guns in Australia or England. However, if you look in Australia and England, they have a higher rate of sexual assault and rape than we do here in America. So in those two countries...
What about the argument that there hasn't been a mass shooting in Australia since they did the gun confiscation program?
Well, you're going to have that potential, but the assault weapon is a tool. It's like an automobile or a chainsaw or a tractor or the cell phone that people have in their cars, and it costs thousands of people to die every year. So it's a trade-off. It's a tool, and I would love not to carry my firearm. It's a tool. There's nothing romantic about it. It's dangerous. However, in order for me not to carry it, you have to get rid of carjackings, murders, and people who create sexual assault.
Thanks, Chuck. Thanks for the call. Josh Gellers.
Sure. So this is actually an interesting point. I think history is absolutely important when trying to examine this issue. And so if you go back to the time in which the Second Amendment was actually adopted, guns were, as the caller was sort of intimating, not nearly as effective a tool as some other handheld weapons, especially knives. So the ability of guns to protect an individual in terms of their capacity, in terms of the speed with which they can be used, has definitely increased over time. But then you also have to think about, in a particular instance in which, say, a woman's life is going to be threatened, whether she will have the wherewithal and the ability to operate a gun on the spot in that kind of an event. And, you know, you cited the example of Australia. And so what's interesting about that case is that in the wake of their largest massacre in Port Arthur in 1996, a conservative-led government decided that they had had enough, and they pushed through these really fundamental changes to their country's gun laws in order to regulate the ownership of firearms. And as you mentioned, they have had declining gun death rates, and there have been no gun-related mass killings in Australia since 1996, whereas in the United States, we have the highest homicide by firearm rate among the world's most developed nations. So there's certainly a balance to be struck in terms of the ability that individuals have to protect themselves, but we really have to look at what are these weapons being used for? Would they even be effective in the kinds of instances that people are citing as the opportunities that people might have to use them?
The caller's comments reflect the views, I'd say, of gun owners who don't like the idea of restrictions on the Second Amendment. Let me ask you as well. Australia doesn't have an organization like the National Rifle Association, which has become such a partisan wedge. Republicans running for office can't afford to get crosswise with the NRA. On the other hand, in this election year, Democrats are now going to use this issue as a litmus test as to whether or not they're sufficiently towing the Democratic Party line in opposing the NRA. How do you see the politics of that playing out?
Well, certainly the NRA has been a very effective lobbying force in Congress, having donated millions of dollars to largely Republicans who support their policies. But what I think is really important to look back on is, what is it that the American people want? And so if we're going to elect someone that represents the will of the people, and there seems to be a tenor in the United States that across party lines, people are upset and they're trying to grapple with the fact that this is a regular occurrence in a country that has great legal enforcement, that has, a robust military, and that privileges its freedoms in addition. So how is someone going to represent those views and the complexity of the United States? And so there was a poll that just came out on Monday in advance of the votes that showed that 92% of Americans support expanded background checks and 85% support preventing those on terror watch lists from buying guns. Now, of course, in the latter case, that would not have prevented Omar Mateen from being able to acquire guns because he'd been taken off of the FBI's terrorist watch list. But the overwhelming majority of Americans favor at least expanded background checks. And so I think Donald Trump is trying to, as the heir apparent to the Republican Party, trying to figure out how to navigate the fact that the American electorate overwhelmingly supports expanded background checks. But yet, as you mentioned, it's really important that he speaks to the Republican base and to one of their more powerful interest groups, which is the National Rifle Association.
Let's go now to Bill in Arlington. Hi, Bill. Good morning.
Good evening. Good morning, Melissa. You know, this adage, and I listened to your first caller about the riflemen and all of the we're focusing on the wrong issue. As Americans, when you start relating to Australia, pretty much everyone loves Australians. You go around the world and everybody would like to be an Australian. They'd like to talk like them. They'd like to live like them. We as Americans, a lot of folks don't understand, we're hated around the world. We're hated for our success in businesses. We're hated for our standard of living. We're hated for the fact that most of our people that even live in poverty are living better than most folks in third world countries. So to be an American or to be looked upon as an American from overseas, we're pretty much disliked, except for a few countries like Germany or Britain, and that's because we've saved them so many times. We're fighting a war here that is based on evil. It's not based on high-capacity magazines. It's not based on assault weapons. It's based on the fact that there are whole throngs of people that just want to do evil against Americans. So the idea of a ban on assault weapons is a diversion away from the idea that there are a large, large number of people around the world that hate us, and some of those people are nut jobs, and they are allowed to come into our country and wreak havoc. This gentleman passed every kind of background check he could pass, still got in. I'm concerned about the level of lists, the number of lists that are out there that you can be on. If that's the case, half the people on my Facebook feed should be on some kind of a list because of the way they feel about the Obama administration. I think we're barking up the wrong tree here. We need to change how we go about treating other countries. This last shooter said that he wanted the United States to stop bombing Syria and his homeland. Well, you know what? There are thousands of people that feel the same way, and it only takes a few of those to come into the country and do something like they did in Orlando.
Well, he was a U.S. citizen, though, Bill. Omar Mateen was born in this country.
He had been radicalized. Yeah. He had been radicalized by what he hears on places like Al Jazeera and some of the other news agencies that are allowed to freely broadcast in this country. You want to do something real good? Stop them from having an internet feed to the folks in our country.
Okay.
They're radicalizing them. They're brainwashing them.
Thanks, Bill. That's a Bill in Arlington. Okay. Josh Gellers. Let's talk about this. Because as I mentioned at the top of the hour, those who lean Democratic are overwhelmingly concerned about the gun issue. Those that lean Republican tend to be a lot more concerned about the terrorism issue. Your thoughts?
Yeah, well, I mean, you have to be concerned with both, certainly. And I think that the caller highlights an important concern that people certainly have, voters who are looking to a candidate to see what kind of stance that they're going to take and whether they're going to come down hard on rooting out terrorism at home and abroad, and how that's going to affect civil liberties here in the United States. And so the question becomes, how does the next leader of the United States address these at times competing issues? And so if the concern is that other people around the world have designs on doing things that will be harmful to U.S. citizens, the question becomes, how can we embolden law enforcement and the federal government to provide a measure of security so that we can identify these people beforehand and prevent them from gaining access to weapons and engaging in the kinds of acts that we have come to, unfortunately, see on a semi-regular basis at this point. So there's going to have to be a strong conversation, not just on these sort of ad hoc amendments, but really a comprehensive effort to address the need to examine the factors that lead to terrorism. And one of the proposals that was actually promoted by Republicans addressed this in brief by directing the Attorney General to conduct a study on, quote, the various sources and causes of mass shootings, including psychological factors, the impact of video games and other things. But presumably that would also include a discussion about the factors that lead to radicalization of individuals, how to identify these people who have some reason to be suspected by the federal government as having violent intentions toward the country.
And let me just jump in and ask you, Omar Mateen had been flagged by the FBI. He was on their radar. I think that's what has been so frustrating for people to learn. He was, in fact, they were aware of him, but they took him off their list at a certain point.
Right. So I think the unnerving part about this, the part that really gets to the core of the fears that Americans have, is you see a situation like this where someone had, as you mentioned, had been on the selectee list and yet was taken off. And so he was able to, without any real difficulty, purchase firearms, which allowed him to engage in this atrocious act in Orlando. And so moving forward, we have to think about how is it that we can prevent someone like that? Does it involve more surveillance that obviously is going to affect the issue of civil liberties and individual freedoms? You know, Donald Trump in the past has talked about, deporting Muslims, obviously that, people who are immigrants, has come down certainly hard on that as well. But in the case, as you mentioned to the caller, that would not have solved this particular issue because we're dealing with an American citizen. So how is it that we are going to identify people who have a tendency or have expressed an interest in engaging in violent acts without curtailing the civil liberties that people want to enjoy and have for decades here in the U.S.?
Yeah. Well, Josh Geller, it's always a pleasure to have you on the show. Thanks for providing your thoughts, and thanks to all of our callers as well. Thanks for being with us, Josh.
Thanks so much.
Josh is an assistant professor of political science at the University of North Florida, and much more still ahead. Later, find out about Jacksonville's new Formosan Termite Task Force. Have you heard about that problem? We'll tell you about it. Also, a look at the Green Hands Sustainability Fest at the St. Augustine Amphitheater this weekend. But up next, the new PBS film, The Committee, airing on WJCT television this week, documenting the state's dark history of anti-gay discrimination. That's coming up back in a moment.
Legal and political segments on First Coast Connect, brought to you by Farrah and Farrah. WJCT's Generation Listen and Pratt Guys present Camp Listen, a free listening party event for young public radio listeners. Come to the Pratt Guys showroom on Friday, June 24th from 6 to 9 p.m. for this free gathering featuring food, drinks, prizes, live music, and great stories as heard on public radio. RSVP today at camplisten.eventbrite.com. WJCT's Generation Listen is sponsored by Grassroots Natural Market.
If you're a small coffee farmer in southern Mexico, it's best to be in a grower's co-op. Otherwise,
they are essentially left at the mercy of the local middlemen, or los coyotes, as they call them in Chiapas.
I'm Kai Rizdal. Fair trade is not necessarily easy trade. We'll have that story and today's numbers from Wall Street as well, of course, next time on Marketplace.
Weekday evenings at 6 on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
This July 4th, join me, Tom Bergeron, as I host America's National Independence Day celebration, A Capital Fourth. They'll be singing and dancing with the Stars and Stripes with Smokey Robinson, Kenny Loggins, Cassidy Pope, Amber Riley, Jackie Evancho, Sutton Foster, the cast of the Broadway musical On Your Feet, and the most dazzling display of fireworks anywhere in the USA. Live from the U.S. Capitol, it's A Capital Fourth.
Coming Monday, July 4th on WJCT Public Television.
On the next Fresh Air, a chapter of early American history many of us know little about, slavery in the New England colonies. Native Americans were enslaved and exported. African slaves were imported. We talk with Wendy Warren, author of the new book, New England Bound, Slavery and Colonization in Early America. She teaches history at Princeton. Join us weekdays at noon on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
Oprah Winfrey returns to TV tonight in a new show about a black megachurch under scrutiny.
One of the cops who works around here came to see me and told me about a 15-year-old girl from the church who'd come in and gave a statement.
Eric Deggans tells us about Greenleaf. Later on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Today at 4 on 89.9 WJCT, your community, your world. Who is your American graduate champion? WJCT is looking to recognize and honor a wide range of community leaders and everyday heroes who regularly dedicate their time, talent, and resources to prepare students for success and graduation. American graduate champions are role models in their communities whose stories have the potential to inspire others to take action. The nomination deadline is July 15th at 5 p.m. Click the button on WJCT.org to nominate your American graduate champion today.
Welcome back. Well, Formosan termites have caused quite a bit of concern in Jacksonville recently, particularly in the historic Riverside Avondale neighborhood. An infestation of these stubborn pests, and they are an invasive species, is leading to the demolition of the city's Old Woman's Club, which is next to the Kummer Museum. In fact, this is so serious that there's a new task force in town to fight the problem. Erin Harlow is a commercial horticulture agent with the Duval County Extension Office, and she is the director of the new Formosan Subterranean Termite Task Force in Jacksonville. Erin, a pleasure. Thanks for being here.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
And here's our question to callers. What are your questions about the new Formosan Termite Task Force in the city of Jacksonville? It's your chance to connect with Erin from the Duval County Extension Office. Get on the line. Let us know what your questions and thoughts are about this at 549-2937. So recently it was discovered that these termites had infested this historic building next to the Kummer Museum. And frankly, it was a calamity for historic preservation and efforts to refurbish the space. Can you explain why these Formosan termites are so damaging?
Sure. So our Formosan termites, they are subterranean termite. So we have eastern subterraneans already here in Jacksonville. But these termites are much larger in numbers. So the colony is a lot greater. You can have several million individuals in one colony. So they're much more damaging.
How are they different from regular termites?
Sure. Again, just the size of the colony. You may not notice them for several years, and that can be a problem. So when you do notice them, the damage is fairly extensive or can be.
They can multiply really rapidly, can't they?
It's fairly quick, yeah.
Yeah.
It's just high numbers.
So that's why there was just too many of them, I guess, to save the building?
You know, at the Kummer, I have looked through their report, and they have a lot of damage from, you know, previous termites as well. So, you know, I can't really say what's going to happen to the Kummer, and you know, I've got to let them deal with that. But we do know they have previous termite damage. It's a very old building. Mm-hmm. So really, it goes down to structural engineering. You know, what can they save and what can they not save?
Right. And do we know how these termites have gotten into our area?
Sure. So they're pretty much all over Florida at this point. Our first report, or one of our first reports in Jacksonville, was around 2005. So they've been in Jacksonville for approximately 10 years, a little bit longer even. And so we do know they are in several parts of town.
And we'll go to your calls in a moment with Erin Harlow at the Duval County Extension Office, heading up the new Formosan Termite Task Force, especially if you live in Riverside. Let us know if you're worried at all about this and what your questions are at 549-2937. In fact, they have found termites, Formosan termites, at 9 more Riverside locations. Is that right?
We have definitely confirmed cases all up and down Riverside
Avenue. All up and down Riverside Avenue.
Yeah, I mean, we've got lots of termites down there in Riverside. You know, we do want to let residents know that you know, they do need to be vigilant. They need to look for them. They need to hire professional pest control companies. But don't panic. So that's really the message we want to bring people is, let's not panic. The building is not going to fall down tomorrow. We do need to look for them. We are getting information out to residents and starting the task force or education to kind of help them walk through the process and get a community-wide educational campaign going.
And you are heading up the city's new Formosan Termite Task Force. Can you tell us about this effort?
Sure. It's a partnership with the mayor's office in the city of Jacksonville and the University of Florida, the Extension Office. So again, we'll be focusing on lots of different areas. Mainly, you know, we're starting in the Riverside area, and we're looking at educational campaigns. We're looking at some of the city property, the trees in particular, kind of how to manage it the best way we can, getting residents information. And we know looking at New Orleans area, that a citywide approach is going to be the best.
And how? So New Orleans has had the same problem.
Correct. Yeah.
And how did they deal with it?
They had Operation Full Stop, and it's been going, you know, several years ago. They had that, and it was a government-funded program. That's the only difference between ours and theirs. So we don't have that opportunity.
Okay.
So ours is going to be much more citizen-based.
How can citizens help with this? And once the termites are there, isn't it almost impossible to get rid of this particular kind of termite?
Okay, so in the two questions there, Formosan termites we can actually control and treat.
You can't.
Absolutely, yeah. It will take a little bit of time. Now, we do recommend there's a couple options for treatments. Bait stations are usually the best option that we have now, okay? They may do liquid treatments as well or a combination of, and this is for post-construction. But they do work. It may take up to 3 months is kind of our guideline that we go with, but they will work. Now, you have to maintain the treatment. That's the key. If you don't maintain the treatments, we do know from New Orleans within 18 months, the termites can come back.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why we want that citywide, kind of group effort, because everybody needs to be treating their property effectively.
Everybody all over the city, with older wood homes.
Yeah, we're going to focus on Riverside area first.
Okay,
and that's really, you know, again, we know that there's a problem there. Although we have had reports from the San Marco area, for instance, Springfield, and we've got representatives from Springfield and also Riverside on the task force.
How can people learn more about the task force and
sure.
be part of that?
So we've got our website. We have the Volcanic Extension Office. So it's actually easiest if you just Google or use your search engine to look for Duval County Extension termites, and it will come up. So we've got information there. We also have a class coming up, and we'll be doing several of these throughout the community. Our first one is at Web West Connect Library. It's going to be on July 18th.
Okay.
From 6 to 7. It's free. And we'll just talk about termites. They can answer questions, the different types of conducive conditions at your home. But if they want to register for that, just call our office at 904-255-7450 to register for that termite class.
All right. She is Erin Harlow, heading up the new Formosan Termite Task Force in Jacksonville. And she's also with the Duval County Extension Office. Thanks so much for being here.
No problem. Thank you for having me.
We'll be right back.
From the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX, I'm Al Letson of Reveal.
Always sworn to secrecy.
What happens if they have evidence?
Can I record on the tour?
Can't do that.
I just had a few follow-up questions for you since we last spoke.
We peel back layers of real-life mysteries over the airwaves every single week on Reveal.
Thursday at 1 on 89.9 WJCT.
Chasing the Dream, Poverty and Opportunity in America is a multi-platform public media initiative that provides a deeper understanding of the impact of poverty on American society. Tune in to the PBS NewsHour weeknights at 7 on WJCT-TV for compelling stories of individuals and organizations addressing such issues. And log on to chasingthedreamproject.org. Funding for this initiative is provided by the JPB Foundation and Ford Foundation. Local funding provided by Wells Fargo.
I'm Jackie Carter, Executive Secretary for Duval County's Emergency Operations Center. Have a plan for home, work, and school. Planning can save you valuable time and money in a disaster. Visit jacksready.com for more information and tune to 89.9, the designated emergency broadcaster for Northeast Florida.
WJCT and Baptist Health invite you to Girls Day Out, Saturday, September 17th at the Hyatt Hotel. Enjoy breakfast, lunch, great speakers, including celebrity chef My Fam, and Good Morning America host and breast cancer survivor Amy Robach. Tickets are $40. log on to wjct.org/girlsdayout.
Big day at the job. Make it break time. They're all waiting for you right now in the conference room. Well, they're going to have to wait, because you're not leaving the radio until you hear the end of that story. Snap judgment from NPR. Storytelling with a beat. Do not miss it.
Sundays at 1 on 89.9 WJCT.
Who is your American Graduate Champion? WJCT is looking to recognize and honor a wide range of community leaders and everyday heroes who regularly dedicate their time, talent, and resources to prepare students for success and graduation. American Graduate Champions are role models in their communities whose stories have the potential to inspire others to take action. The nomination deadline is July 15th at 5 p.m. Click the button on WJCT.org to nominate your American Graduate Champion today.
Well, welcome back. Two film events are coming up at the St. Augustine Amphitheater, and while they themselves will be a lot of fun, the bigger story is the amphitheater's Green Hands Initiative. We're pleased to welcome right now Ryan Murphy, Director of Cultural Events for St. Johns County. Good morning.
Good morning.
And also with us, Amy Robb, the publisher of Edible Northeast Florida. Good morning.
Good morning, Melissa.
All right, Ryan, let's start with you. What's happening at the amphitheater?
So the Green Hands Initiative is something that kind of just came about as we realized the amount of sustainability we wanted to do, and seeing a lot of the tours come through and a lot of their initiatives and how they tour in a greener manner. Uh-huh. And a lot of them will tour with a company called Reverb. It's a nonprofit that kind of makes sure that these tours, you know, live up to their sustainability goals. And so with that, we started looking at the composting we could do, the, you know, active recycling. We have a garden now that actually produces food that we feed the artists, stuff like that. Uh-huh. And then one of the biggest things we recently did was we replaced all the bottled water, and we have water refill stations now for not only the people coming to the concerts, but all the people working the concerts as well.
And that's called the One Less Plastic Bottle Program.
Exactly.
Yeah, so just fewer plastic bottles when you go to see a show. Amy Robb, you're the publisher of a new magazine, relatively new magazine in town, Edible Northeast Florida.
Correct.
And how are you guys involved in all this?
Well, we obviously deal with food, but more than that, we also deal with food systems. We're interested in talking about food systems. And when you talk about food systems, you're talking about farms and land and waterways and the sea. And that gets quickly into issues of sustainability and how to protect and preserve those resources. So we saw that the amphitheater was working on their Green Hands Initiative, and we thought that's something we'd like to be a part of.
Sure. And so there will be more than one opportunity for people to be part of this, beginning with a screening of a documentary called Tapped, and this is about the bottled water industry, right?
Correct, yeah. And we'll be showing it at the amphitheater this Saturday, and at the concert hall on Sunday. Both events are free. We're going to have live music. There's a bunch of nonprofits that are going to be there on display talking about their sustainability goals and initiatives. And then, yeah, it's going to be great.
And what is Tapped all about? Just what really goes on in terms of bottled water?
Yeah. I'll let Amy.
Yeah. Tell me about Tapped.
So Tapped, this actually came about through a partnership with the U.S. Green Building Council in the North Florida chapter here in Jacksonville. And they have graciously allowed us to do a screening of this documentary. Mm-hmm. And it really takes aim at looking at the bottled water industry and its lack of regulation. It also looks at what happens to the plastics used in the bottling process and what happens to those plastics after.
So there will be two opportunities to see this. 8 o'clock Saturday night at the amphitheater. You can go see TAP for free. And then Sunday at the Pontevedra Concert Hall, they'll screen it at 6 o'clock with cocktails. So two opportunities this weekend. But this is a series. There'll be other things you guys are targeting as well.
Ideally, this was the beginning when we partnered with Amy and Edible as far as trying to show these films and kind of tying it around the initiatives we're doing. So the water one was big for us. And, I mean, since we started this program with the refillable water stations, we're measuring it now, but there's thousands of bottles that have been saved. And that's just on the audience size side, because we're measuring that. But again, working backstage, the amount of stagehands and artist crew that go through bottled water, it's crazy. At the end of the show, we'd be filling dumpsters with these things.
Oh, man.
Half-drank water bottles. So you end up realizing, you know, people are taking a sip, putting it down, taking a sip, putting it down. So at this point, we realize we have to get canteens and be being a little better about this.
And, but you said some acts that perform at the amphitheater have, of their own volition, started to change their habits. How are they doing that?
Absolutely. They sometimes they'll bring that group reverb, and then other times they'll do a lot of the things like the riders we get. They want to make sure that we're locally sourcing a lot of the food we're bringing in. They want to make sure there's no plastic water. There's no water bottles. There's only glass being used. They want to see, they get really excited about seeing us have a garden or compost. They want to have recycling bins in their dressing rooms. So it's gone from that party backstage lifestyle to a more responsible,
the new socially conscious rock and roll lifestyle. Can you tell us which performers are the most engaged on all this stuff?
Absolutely. The whole seed of this actually came from Jack Johnson, and that's part of his huge mission. But when we were lucky enough to have Jack Johnson come a couple of years ago, it was his only Florida show. We had to basically make sure we measured up to his guidelines as far as sustainability, and we did, and we got the show. But Alabama Shakes, who recently came through, are phenomenal people. They also had similar guidelines, but there's a lot of the artists that are coming through that have that.
Very nice.
Curious and interested.
And Edible is based in, your offices are based in St. Augustine too.
They
so
sure are.
There's a real community in St. Augustine around all this.
There is, and we're happy to be part of it.
All right. So again, you can be part of this as well. It's a green film series through Edible Northeast Florida, the U.S. Green Building Council, and the St. Augustine Amphitheater. Go see Tapped Saturday night at the amphitheater, or you can check it out Sunday at the Ponte Vedra Concert Hall.
Yeah.
Amy Robb, publisher of Edible, Ryan Murphy, director of cultural events in St. Johns County. Thanks for being here.
Thanks, Melissa.
Thank you.
We'll be right back.
Catherine Burns, one of the hosts of the Moth Radio Hour, and I hope you'll join us here on 89.9 WJCT. With true personal stories told live without notes to standing room crowds around the world, Moth stories aren't part of the disposable daily information flow. They stick with you, and you'll even find yourself retelling them. Listen Saturdays at 3 p.m. here on 89.9 WJCT.
This is the sound of drama. This is the sound of your community.
Good morning, live from Studio 5. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. Thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross.
Stay informed. Enjoy live streaming of your favorite local WJCT and PBS and NPR content, all free from your devices. The WJCT app, available now in the Apple App Store and Google Play.
If you're a small coffee farmer in southern Mexico, it's best to be in a grower's co-op. Otherwise,
they are essentially left at the mercy of the local middlemen, or los coyotes, as they call them in Chiapas.
I'm Kai Rizdal. Fair trade is not necessarily easy trade. We'll have that story and the day's numbers from Wall Street as well, of course, next time on Marketplace.
Weekday evenings at 6 on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
Welcome back. Well, finally this hour, it's the Emmy Award-winning documentary film that airs this week on more than 100 PBS stations nationwide, including WJCT Television tomorrow night. It's called The Committee, and it tells the story of a Florida legislature panel that engaged in a McCarthy-esque political witch hunt. But they weren't going after suspected communists. Instead, they were targeting people at state universities they suspected of being gay. Right now, we welcome filmmaker Lisa Mills. She is with the University of Central Florida, and she's on the line with more about the committee. Lisa, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Melissa.
So how did this project come about? Tell us about the committee.
Well, The Committee was actually a documentary film made in an honors interdisciplinary documentary class at the University of Central Florida. We started working on it in fall of 2011 and continued in 2012. It outlines the Florida Legislative Investigative Committee's persecution of LGBTQ students and professors in the late 50s and early 60s at Florida's public universities. Now, this legislative committee is better known as the Johns Committee, but even though I'm from Florida, I didn't know that this had happened until my colleague, Dr. Robert Casanello in the History Department here at UCF, told me about it. We told our students about it, they were intrigued, and we worked very hard to line up survivors of this committee and one interrogator and interview them for the film.
And that includes a couple of people. That includes a couple of people from Jacksonville, doesn't it?
Yes, that's right. Dr. Judith Poucher is an expert on this, and she wrote a book called State of Defiance, where she gives a lot of interesting details of people that were interrogated during this time. And then Reverend Ruth Jensen Forville lives in Jacksonville. And she was actually one of the students interrogated at Florida State University. She talks about being interrogated 17 hours by this committee without any break at all.
And let's listen to that excerpt from the film The Committee. Jacksonville's the Reverend Ruth Jensen Forville describes her interrogation at Florida State. Let's listen.
They took me into the basement of the administration building and to a room, and I was there for at least 15 hours. I think it was probably closer to 17 because it was the next day. During that time, I was not offered the opportunity to go to the bathroom, to have anything to eat, or to have anything to drink. All they wanted to know were the names of people. Did you have relationships with other women on the campus? What about this, you know, these people? I said, no. Did you see anybody doing this or that? You know, and they would be pretty graphic in what they said. It was almost like there was a very deliberate attempt to keep me longer and longer and longer so I'd be more and more tired. And I just kept saying no because I hadn't. If I had, it would have been different. I don't know how I would have reacted, because then it would have been a matter of honesty. So I was afraid of everything, who I talked to, what happened. So I ended up not going to classes, took incompletes, and didn't go back. And so I ended up with an academic probation. I knew what was on the record, and they said, you know, you're a lesbian, you can't be a lesbian and come to a state college.
All right, and that's the Reverend Ruth Jensen Forville. She was 19 at the time when this was all going on. Lisa Mills, in 1964, the Johns Committee published a pamphlet. It was called Homosexuality and Citizenship in Florida, and it was supposed to shock Floridians into acting against gays and lesbians. But instead, it provoked a backlash. Isn't that right?
Yes, that's right. The notorious Purple Pamphlet. It was actually ruled obscene by the state attorney in Miami-Dade. And rumor has it that these purple pamphlets were actually selling on the street of New York City at the time for $25 a piece. It was a great embarrassment to the state of Florida, and it really brought the downfall of the Johns Committee. Everybody understood then that they were really treading in very dangerous territory, and they were dissolved by the legislature.
But they were active for almost 10 years. They were successful in firing or expelling more than 200 teachers and students. You interview former Senator Bob Graham in this film, and he talks about how the Johns Committee degraded the national standing of Florida universities as well. So in light of the mass shooting at the Pulse nightclub in Orlando, where an LGBT club was targeted, what are your hopes for how people can look at this historical perspective about the history of anti-gay discrimination in Florida?
Well, I guess what it reminds me of now is the witch hunt that we're on right now in terms of our Muslim community. We just can't allow these sorts of witch hunts to happen, no matter who is being the victim at the time. You know, I think that Orlando has really come together now around this incident. It's always good to look back and be reminded of our history so that we don't repeat it. And I think that now what we're looking at is sort of a different kind of discrimination as a backlash, ironically, to the shooting in Orlando. And I just have to say that the University of Central Florida, one of the first organizations at UCF to come out and support our LGBT community, was the Muslim Student Association. They're actually the largest student association at UCF, and they were right there on Sunday reaching out to try to help. And so it's just so ironic, isn't it, the way all of this keeps, history repeats itself in lots of different ways.
Well, the committee is airing nationwide on PBS stations this week. It will air tomorrow night here in Jacksonville on WJCT television. She is Associate Professor of Film at UCF, filmmaker Lisa Mills. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
And that's our show. Thanks to all of our guests and callers. Our producer is Sean Birch. The show theme composed and performed by the Jacksonville Symphony's Pyotr Chevchik. Never miss a show. Subscribe to the daily podcast on iTunes and Stitcher and watch the show video on demand at tvjax.com. Next on Diane Rehm, British voters go to the polls on Thursday to decide whether or not to stay in the European Union. A look at what the exit vote could mean for the U.S., the remaining EU members, and the post-war structure of Europe. That's next. I'm Melissa Ross, and you're listening to First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT-FM Jacksonville. Your community, your world. We'll be right back here again at 9 a.m. tomorrow. Have a great day.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.